From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In Hong Kong Thursday, police shut down the second of three protest camps, dismantling tents and clearing out a street camp in the Admiralty District near the city government offices. Assistant Commissioner of Police Cheung Tak Kyung briefed the media on the clearance of roads in Admiralty late Thursday.
After providing sufficient time for the illegal occupiers to leave the areas on their own, police cordoned the area at about 2:20 and started to remove the obstacles and reopen roads at Admiralty and central areas. After about 2 hours, police removed 21 sets of obstacles from the areas. During the process, most of the illegal occupiers did not resort to violence or provocation to resist or obstruct police enforcement actions. They complied with the police instruction by presenting their identity cards for recording before leaving. 909 people were allowed to leave the area after police had recorded their personal particulars. Police may pursue criminal liability against them later because they have committed the offense. Regrettably, the remaining illegal occupiers refused to leave. Despite numerous police advice and warnings, they behave in an uncooperative manner. At about 4:25 this afternoon, police started arresting those who continued to engage in the unlawful assembly so as to reopen the roads. We arrested altogether 209 people. As for the illegally occupied road sections in Causeway Bay, we will remove the obstacles and reopen the relevant roads at an appropriate time. We urge members of the public not to gather or linger at the illegally occupied area in Causeway Bay and to stay away from the radicals and troublemakers. Do not be incited to commit any illegal acts. I stress that police are duty-bound to maintain public peace and to protect public order and public safety. We will take resolute action against anyone who disrupts public order by blocking other roads or roads that have been reopened. Police have stepped up patrol at relevant location, and we will take strict enforcement actions against anyone who plans or attempts to reopen our roads or places.
The camp in the Admiralty District was the last large one remaining. The other, in the Mong Kok area, was cleared out late last month. A small encampment remains in Causeway Bay, a shopping district. Many Hong Kong residents voiced support for the clearance operation at a site that has choked roads in the city's financial district for more than 2 months. They said they preferred to return to normal life.
We firmly support universal suffrage to elect the Hong Kong SAR government within the framework of Hong Kong's basic law. We support the Hong Kong police. These protests have had a big impact on our lives. Students in Wan Chai haven't been able to go to school. Shops in Wan Chai haven't been able to open. We've been disgusted by the protesters. We want Hong Kong to be governed by law.
The Occupy Central movement has made a great impact on Hong Kong society. Lives have been inconvenienced and the economy has suffered. Social order has been damaged. We hope this chaos can come to an early end.
Despite attempts over the past year by the US and EU to smother it with economic sanctions, Russia continues to put together major business deals with its BRICS partners and others around the world. Thursday saw the announcement of a set of major agreements with the world's second most populous country, India. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi described the outcome of his talks with the Russian President Vladimir Putin as ambitious. Russia will help New Delhi build 12 more nuclear reactors, and the two countries signed a deal to build advanced helicopters together. Modi said Russia remains India's most important defense partner. RT's Neil Harvey has more.
Russia and India, of course, quite a distance apart, although that distance has proved no obstacle to the forging of trade deals between the two nations. A whole host of agreements have been made today. Let's start with by far the most significant of those, and that is a deal for Russia's nuclear energy corporation, or Rosatom, to supply India with 12 nuclear reactors over a time period of 20 years. Six of those will go to the Kudan Kulam power station. Now, this is a project the two countries have been working on together since way back in 1998. There's already one Russian-designed reactor online. A second one is in test mode, and this agreement now ensures further cooperation between the two nations. And this power station also promises to be potentially the safest in the world.
Kudan Kulam is the first nuclear power plant in the world that's built according to so-called post-Fukushima requirements. It fully complies with all the modern standards, and many of our nuclear partners even come here to India to take a look at the plant and see how it's built.
So that was the biggest deal of the day, but plenty more worth mentioning. Firstly, Rosneft has struck an agreement to supply India with oil for another 10 years. Rosneft and Gazprom together have brokered an agreement with some leading Indian companies on future exploration of the Arctic shelf. And also a very topical one, this relates to diamonds. Russia, the biggest producer of rough diamonds in the world. India, the biggest processor of rough diamonds in the world. Now, previously, Russia was sending a lot of its diamonds to places like Antwerp and Dubai, which would then make their way on to India. Now they've decided that they want to cut out the middleman more often. So there's an awful lot of promise from the deals that we've seen so far, and I suspect there'll be still more to come.
Sriram Chawla is the Dean of the Jindal School of International Affairs in New Delhi.
India is power-starved, and we are trying to diversify our basket of sources beyond fossil fuels, and it is quite welcome. The Russian assistance has historically always been with us on nuclear energy, and I think it's a very ambitious plan to have 12 new reactors to rev up more electricity as the Indian economy grows. So I think it's a huge contribution. Russia has always been with us on building our capacities, and right now, given that there is an economic recession in Russia, given that India is growing, I think there's a lot in the Indian market, the potential in the civilian sector that needs to be tapped. And I think President Putin and Prime Minister Modi have today struck the right notes by talking about this whole, you know, diversified range of sectors in which we can cooperate beyond the defense, which of course remains the, you know, a cornerstone. But I think now I think the vision is there because Mr. Modi wants, you know, Russian investments and Indian companies are also eager to invest on the other side in Russia and to tap the potential, especially with energy and infrastructure. So, and even civil aviation, pharmaceuticals, you name it. I mean, there's so much complementarity between our two economies. It has not been realized well in the past. We have neglected it. And now is the time to go defense plus. I would say don't ignore the defense sector, but do defense plus and diversify. And that's how we can actually make it a stronger relationship. Because if you look at India's ties with China or with the United States or other great powers, it's pretty diversified, and it should be that way. And I think it's high time that we do it. Now there's a momentum behind the Eurasian Economic Union that President Putin is pushing for. And I think India wants access to the 170 million consumers of this new customs union, which is going to be inaugurated next year. So all these mean that Russia is never faded away, but it's actually becoming more important for us. And conversely, I think India and China will be the, you know, centerpieces for President Putin's pivot to Asia as a retort to the Western sanctions on Russia since the Ukraine crisis began. Maybe. So I think we are talking about a Russia-India axis with a more, you know, contemporary tenor and a more current needs-based approach, because right now both of us need each other far more than before. There is this north-south corridor, international north-south corridor, transport corridor, which if we can work out is going to bind India and Russia closer, especially through gas. So nuclear energy is just a small part of India's energy mix. Gas can make a huge difference, a much bigger. And I think if we can work out the transit routes, the pipelines, the shipments, there's immense potential for Russian gas to also reach India, just as it's now making headway to in China.
In the aftermath of the release of a report by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence over the CIA's detention and interrogation practices, CIA Director John Brennan Thursday spoke to reporters. After a 13-minute preamble, alleging essentially that a siege mentality at Langley in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 events was responsible for any lapses in the agency's behavior, he laid out his points of disagreement with the Senate report, which was issued earlier this week.
As to the issues on which we part ways with the committee, I have already stated that our reviews indicate that the detention and interrogation program produced useful intelligence that helped the United States thwart attack plans, capture terrorists, and save lives. But let me be clear. We have not concluded that it was the use of EITs within that program that allowed us to obtain useful information from detainees subjected to them. The cause and effect relationship between the use of EITs and useful information subsequently provided by the detainee is, in my view, unknowable. Irrespective of the role EITs might play in a detainee's provision of useful information, I believe effective non-coercive methods are available to elicit such information. Methods that do not have a counterproductive impact on our national security and on our international standing. It is for these reasons that I fully support the President's decision to prohibit the use of EITs. Another key point with which we take issue is the study's characterization of how CIA briefed the program to the Congress, the media, and within the executive branch, including at the White House. The record simply does not support the study's inference that the agency repeatedly, systematically, and intentionally misled others on the effectiveness of the program. To be clear, there were instances where representations about the program that were used or approved by agency officers were inaccurate, imprecise, or fell short of our tradecraft standards. We have acknowledged such mistakes, and I have been firm in declaring that they were unacceptable for an agency whose reputation and value to the policymaker rests on the precision of the language it uses every day in intelligence reporting and analysis. Primarily, however, the study's contention that we repeatedly and intentionally misled the public and the rest of the U.S. government rests on the committee's view that detainees subjected to EITs did not produce useful intelligence, a point on which we still fundamentally disagree.
Brennan appeared to be saying that the position of the CIA was intended to assure CIA staffers that their work will not be reviewed simply because of a change of administration.
As far as morale here at the agency, this is a tremendous, tremendous workforce, as I said. I had a session with the agency workforce yesterday, and I talked about the importance of the mission. And the CIA's mission is as important today as it was before this report came out, and it's going to be even more important tomorrow. And one of the great things about this workforce is it's able to focus on what it is that they're asked to do. The CIA officers are operating in some very, very dangerous places and are doing this on behalf of their fellow Americans. And so there is some concern and disappointment about what has happened. There certainly is concern about the misrepresentations that they think are circulating now out in the public, but they are determined to make sure that they're able to do what they need to do.
The release of the report also spotlighted the role of a number of other nations in the CIA's rendition and torture program. RT's Marina Portnaya reports.
We've been seeking comment or reaction regarding the newest and disturbing revelations about how America treated suspected terrorists post 9/11. Very little response so far, particularly from European countries who've declined the opportunity to criticize the Obama administration for not holding any official accountable for executing brutal and arguably illegal enhanced interrogation tactics. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Czech Republic says it's made no official statement regarding the report, and as a matter of principle, the Czech Republic says it does not interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. Lithuania's foreign ministry says torture and violations of human rights are unacceptable and cannot be tolerated. Lithuania has initiated and conducted a thorough investigation concerning the alleged transportation and confinement of persons detained by the CIA. One of America's closest allies, the UK, says torture is always wrong. Meanwhile, journalists are not providing the Obama administration with such an easy pass. During a State Department press briefing, reporters, one after another, raised questions about U.S. hypocrisy on human rights and international law.
Is going to be when you call for accountability for rights abuses in other countries, how you're going to be able to do that without being essentially laughed out of the room.
I would say, one, we would put our record against any record around the world, and we think it's very rare and unique for a country to decide to put out a report such as this.
All of that is wonderful. You're willing to be transparent about it, although I would say that it took quite a long time for this to come out. But if someone did wrong, are they going to be punished for it? And the answers from the administration seems to be no. So you seem to be saying that, well, we can just air our dirty laundry or however you want to describe it, and that's it.
While most of America's allies have hesitated from publicly criticizing the Obama administration, Afghanistan has broken from unofficial protocol. Afghan President Mohammad Ghani called the CIA's practices unjustifiable, inhumane, and evil, demanding information from the U.S. on Afghan detainees subjected to torture and human rights violations. Attorneys representing detainees held at that prison say they hope the new revelations will lead to those involved being held accountable and prosecuted. If that doesn't happen, the torture report may be seen as an empty statement of fact. Marina Portnaya, RT, New York.
The CIA's use of torture and the U.S. government's refuse to punish those responsible have set back efforts to fight torture worldwide, so said Juan Mendez, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Torture Thursday, amplifying calls by other senior human rights officials for those involved to be prosecuted. Mendez said that the example set by the U.S. on the use of torture, quote, has been a big drawback in the fight against such practice in many other countries throughout the world, closed quote. He stressed that the release of the report was only the first step in the U.S. obligations under the U.N. Convention Against Torture, which also requires the investigation and prosecution of those who are responsible for ordering, planning, or implementing the torture program, adding that, quote, as a nation that frequently calls for transparency and accountability in other countries, the United States must rise to meet the standards it has set both for itself and for others, closed quote. He spoke with RT's Andrew Farmer Wednesday.
That the UN, all the relevant committees, treaty bodies, and special procedures, including my rapporteurship on torture, have always maintained, and because it's clearly the framework of international law applicable to torture, that there is an affirmative obligation to investigate, prosecute, and punish every single act of torture. And we're going to continue to insist on that. We're not going to take no for an answer. But I'm actually hoping that the debate that is generated by the publication of this report creates a momentum to at least start investigating and prosecuting some of the incidents.
The problems with police misconduct in the U.S. criminal justice system do not stop with police killings. Police misconduct is also responsible for wrongful convictions, the prevalence of which has come to light since the use of DNA testing to exonerate the innocent began in 1989. At last report, there's been 321 post-conviction DNA exonerations in the U.S. since the first in 1989, with 254 exonerations since the year 2000. 20 who were exonerated through DNA served time on death row. Another 16 were charged with capital crimes, but not sentenced to death. The average length of time served by exonerees is 13 and a half years. The racial makeup of the 321 exonerees was 202 black defendants, 95 white defendants, 22 Latino defendants, and 2 Asian defendants. DNA-matched suspects and/or perpetrators have been identified in 158 of the DNA exoneration cases. Since 1989, there have been tens of thousands of cases where law enforcement identified and pursued particular suspects, only to find upon DNA testing prior to conviction that they were wrongfully accused. Jeffrey Deskovic is one of those who was wrongfully accused and convicted. Since his release, he has been working to free others wrongfully convicted who are still in prison. We spoke with him Tuesday. Jeffrey, we have in the forefront in the media again the issue of disparate justice, we can call it that as a specific issue, and generally just questions being asked again about the, I guess, the fairness and the accuracy of the criminal justice system in the United States. And you have a peculiar experience with that, of course, that I'd like you to share with our audience, to give us your insights of criminal justice system from inside of it.
Sure. Well, just first, as you alluded to, just by way of background for the audience, I spent 16 years incarcerated in New York from age 17 to 32. I had been wrongfully convicted of a murder and a rape despite a negative DNA test result. Ultimately, I was exonerated after 16 years through further testing, which not only reaffirmed my innocence, but also identified the actual perpetrator. So, yeah, I do have a unique perspective. Certainly the justice system going awry, I'm no stranger to that phenomenon.
Right. And also the justice system coming out with a both an inappropriate finding that you were guilty of something of a crime that you didn't commit, and police misconduct in the process of arriving at that finding. And I think the germane issue right now is that police misconduct. Could you describe what happened to you, from the time that the victim was murdered until you got out, basically?
Yeah, sure. Over a period of 6 weeks, the police played this. Game with me in which I had a number of interaction with them over 6 weeks, in which they, half the time when they would speak to me, they would talk to me as if I was a suspect, and the other half the time, they would pretend as if they needed my help.
You were 17 at the time, right?
16, actually.
16 at the time.
Yes, they would talk to me as if, they would say things like, well, the kids won't talk freely around us, they will around you. Let us know if you have hear any rumors. Stop in from time to time. So they had me in this role as their assistant, their helper. And periodically they would try to get me to take a polygraph. Eventually I did agree to take a polygraph. They told me that they had received some new information which they wanted to share with me, which they thought that once they did that I could be more helpful to them, but that I'd need to take and pass a polygraph first. So like a help us to help you to help them type of, twisted logic.
Right.
So the next day I went to the police station rather than going to school, and they drove me from Peekskill to Brewster. I mean, I thought the polygraph test was going to happen in Peekskill. So that meant I wasn't able to leave on my own. I was dependent upon the police.
Which is like a 45-minute ride and an impossible walk both ways. There's no mass transit going between those two places.
That is correct. And basically, they interrogated me for about 7 hours. They scared me out of my mind. They used threats and false promises, raising their voice at me, good cop, bad cop, asking me the same questions over and over again, invading my personal space. Ultimately, I gave a false, coerced false confession. And by the police officer's own testimony, by the end of the interrogation, I was charged with a murder and a rape. When results came in shortly after that from the FBI lab showing that semen found in the victim didn't match, that really should have ended the case, but instead the prosecution solicited fraud on the part of the medical examiner, and one of the police officers, the polygraphist, who was Putnam County Sheriff's Investigator Daniel Stevens, he fabricated a statement and attributed to me. He claimed that I told him that I didn't know if the perpetrator ejaculated or not, but that was a word that was not in my vocabulary at the time. I mean, I was even a virgin at the time. So that I actually went to trial with Daniel Stevens, and that was one of my claims against him that the jury ruled in my favor. But building on the police misconduct, this time I'm focusing on the Peekskill Police Department. Once the DNA didn't match me, the police went back into the field and they interviewed about 19 witnesses who knew the victim in various capacities, and all of them told the police that she didn't have a boyfriend, that there was no consensual sex, and the police failed to document any of those witness interviews, you know, and therefore that was never turned over to my attorneys. I mean, we could have used that at the trial.
Yeah, I mean, the essence of that would be that since she's not known to have had consensual sex with anyone, and since they found a semen sample that didn't match yours, someone else raped her.
Absolutely, yes.
It's exculpatory in a rape case generally, isn't it?
Right, because the prosecution's whole theory was that, well, the victim was sexually active and in general, and therefore it didn't matter that the semen didn't come from you, because it could have come from consensual sex. But you know, that was a lie based on the medical examiner's fraud. But that was bolstered by the police misconduct, which we just spoke about.
Right. So what kind of fraud did the medical examiner commit?
He claimed, well, when you do an autopsy, there's like audio and written notes which are taken contemporaneously as findings are made, as a means of, you know, ensuring authenticity.
Right, head shows this, as you're working your way down, you take notes, of course, yeah.
Yes, so it was only 6 months after doing that initial autopsy, and only in response to the DNA not matching me, that suddenly, for the first time, the medical examiner claimed that he found medical evidence to show that the victim had been sexually active. You know, he claimed he found perforations in the hymen.
Really?
But during the civil lawsuit, he was forced to admit that these perforations that he claimed he saw did not actually exist.
Really? Hmm. So, I mean, the perforations having been healed, in other words, she had been sexually active at some point prior to the rape and murder.
Right.
Gotcha. So they're impeaching her, impeaching her body as a witness with false testimony.
Yeah, basically, in order to wrongfully convict me, they were willing to trash her reputation. Nice. I mean, flowery talk aside, what they basically were arguing was that, you know, she was, you know, sleeping. That she was sleeping around, and again, that's you're trashing somebody's reputation. That's, you know, dead. I mean, it's really an unseemly thing.
So then you go in and you're in for 16 years, was it, or something?
Yes, it was 16. Yeah, I go in for 16 years. I mean, I lose all seven of my appeals. I was turned down for parole. Seems pretty clear to me I was turned down for parole because I asserted my innocence as opposed to expressing remorse and taking responsibility. Ultimately, I was cleared because further DNA testing via the DNA data bank not only reaffirmed my innocence but also identified the actual perpetrator.
Because he had done it again.
He had killed somebody else again 3.5 years later.
And if he had gone on the straight and narrow, you might never have found him.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I would not have, because that would have meant that his DNA would not have been in the data bank, and therefore, when we got the testing, there wouldn't have been a match, and the state could simply have said, well, this doesn't change anything. We already knew that the DNA didn't match.
So then you find the DNA in the database, and you're going to the local DA to ask them to reopen the case. Did they do that willingly?
Yeah, well, the process was just slightly different. Yeah. They allowed me to have the testing in the first place without having to litigate. Uh-huh. And so they actually got the test results before the defense did. They were responsible for giving the defense the test results. And they went into court and consented to the conviction being overturned. And then when we went back to court, they consented to the conviction the indictment, rather, being dismissed on the grounds of actual innocence.
Was that, were they fully cooperative from the beginning or just from that point?
Well, they were fully cooperative as far as allowing me, from the point we asked them to have further testing, but that was District Attorney DeFiore. I mean, prior to that, when Pira was in office, I mean, her office was not cooperative at all. I mean, they fought all seven of my appeals, even though I was arguing I was innocent based on the DNA test result, you know, just showing the semen didn't match me, and then she also blocked attempts at getting further testing. So they only became cooperative when she left office and, you know, DeFiore took office.
How long were you in prison for that time? How long was that time period?
from when you first made the request with Piero's office to when?
From 97 to 2006.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.